Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. And my guest this week is one of the internet's biggest stars with more than 26 million followers across his platforms. A YouTuber who rose to fame from a very young age, he's since made it to the final on Strictly, has become a best-selling author, actor, business owner, and musician. Born in Wiltshire, his career kicked off following his A-levels when he took up an apprenticeship with his uncle Gary as a roof thatcher. When he wasn't up on the roof, though, he was posting on his YouTube channel, inspired by his older sister Zoe, or Zoella to you and I. Within barely 2 years, he'd vlogged his way to well over a million subscribers and well and truly became part of the UK's YouTube elite. From there, his career snowballed in the sort of way that only the internet can manage. He released a charity single in a boy band, sang with Bono on Band Aid, I know, published the fastest selling graphic novel in British history and voiced characters in multiple Hollywood movies. He even started his own management company with fellow YouTuber Casper Lee. But everything changed in 2018 when he took a giant sequined leap into the mainstream, pasodobling his way into Strictly and making it all the way to the grand final, losing out on the glitter ball to Stacey Dooley, but coming away with the ultimate runners-up prize, a burgeoning romance with his professional partner on the show and now living girlfriend Diane Buswell. As the first YouTuber on Strictly, he well and truly flew the flag for a whole new generation of internet superstars. Following up his performance with a stint on the West End stage in Waitress, an animated kid show called Corpse Talk, a part in K Miller's Syndicate, and now a brand new book called Grow. It's part memoir, part practical guide to inspire us all to disconnect from the digital world and reconnect with the natural world. Let's hear more about it as we dial up Joe Sugg. How are you, sir?
Can I just say that is the best, like, sum up of my last 10 years ever. And can I use that to play just when people ask me what I do for a living? I'm like, right, listen to this podcast. Kate will explain it all perfectly.
I'll send you a PDF script and you can have it.
It's like, listen to this. It hypes me up. Great.
There's no hype intended, my friend. You are a man that's got an audience, the BBC, is envious of. I mean, you are, I can't even begin to get my head around how many people you can talk to and impact.
Yeah, it's it's an unusual one. It's not ever anything that we sort of intended when, well, I say I intended when I started off this sort of journey through social media, but it's I've just sort of rode the wave for the last 10 years, and it's just crazy to look back on and see where I've got to with it.
I mean, you're inventing new paths outright. I mean, you were amongst the first at the forefront of a digital revolution that none of us knew where it was quite going. And you really rolled your sleeves up and just dived straight in. There must have been times when you were going into places and spaces that you just felt like the biggest imposter, because how on earth did a roofer from the countryside get there?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was all those things. It was it's a real, I think, like we said before, there was no one sort of in our space that was doing things to the sort, I guess, the level that our sort of generation of online stars got to. So it was a very, very like unusual time, and I compare it to like other industries and think, like, if I was going down an acting route or a musician route, you can kind of look into the future and see where those industries could get to at the highest level, or, you know, you can sort of see the road sort of paved out in front of you. Whereas the industry that we were in and at the forefront of, we just didn't know where it was going to lead to and how big it would actually get to. So I was, in my mind, I was fully prepared to sort of give it a go for a year. And then if it all didn't pan out, I would just go back to being a roof thatcher.
Yeah, working with your Uncle Gary.
Yeah, Uncle Gazza.
When I look up, like you say, that was the best recap of your last 10 years. It has only been 10 short years, which when you're as old as me, just feels like a chapter in your life rather than probably the significant chapter that it feels to you right now. But boy, oh boy, have you packed a lot into it, to the point that you've almost come full circle, Joe, and you've written this book, Grow, which is about you actually unplugging, disconnecting from the world that has delivered so many riches. But it comes with a cost, doesn't it? A little bit of burnout, a little bit of digital fatigue.
Yeah, definitely. And the whole sort of reason why I wrote a lot about that in the book is because it is something that I didn't think I would ever experience, but I did go through. And it's interesting because I even now I use social media still so much. It's such a vital tool, and the internet in general, we all use it. We've all got this computer at the end of our hands that gives us access to everything and anything. Like, as much as I still love and still use social media, I have sort of reconnected with nature and found like the value in actually getting outside and enjoying the space around me, and even sharing that with friends. And like, we myself and Diane, my girlfriend, we moved to the countryside sort of during the third, just before the third lockdown, I think. And but then since then, it's been, I mean, we moved from London as well. So we experienced a lot of sort of that time of lockdown. And, so, you know, we could go out for that one walk a day, that time when we were allowed one walk a day. I think that's the sort of moment for me where it really sort of hit home of like, actually, you know, now that we're all locked inside, the easy thing to do is to scroll through our phones and sort of live out our lives online. But that for me was a moment where I was like, actually, it's making me now appreciate more than ever the fact that the sort of fundamentals of like a human being, of being outside and appreciating the nature around us, and actually appreciating being able to sort of go on walks and sort of take in the nature around us.
Well, with that in mind, I wanted to dive into my first question with you. So are you ready? You're something of a jack of all trades, which is no mean feat in the entertainment industry, which kind of likes people to stay in their boxes. You kicked off your career in the early 2010s with a rapid rise on YouTube and fast became a central player in a generation of YouTubers before going on to tap into the mainstream. Along the way, you've helped to rewrite, I think, ways in which stars are born using the internet to achieve the kind of audience and mainstream reach that most television networks can only dream of. So, Joe, with the gift of hindsight, with all that we've talked about, with the kind of burnout that you experienced, if you had your time to do it all again, what parts do you think that you would have done differently to prevent you crashing and burning and feeling at times like it had tipped too far into the metaverse and not into the actual universe in which you live?
I think I would have maybe set out with more of a bit more of a game plan, I guess. Like, I mean, nowadays, like, it's tricky because we started our YouTube channel as well. Me personally started my YouTube channel as a bit of fun and just to sort of, you know, there was no real sort of like plan put in place of, you know, I want to do this, upload this many videos per week and do this. And then I aim to get to this and then go on to this. And then the end goal is this. It was very much sort of just go with the flow, see where it ends up. There was no real sort of structure to it, which I think led to sort of an unexpected. It's one of those jobs where it's like the more you put into it, the more you get out of it, social media. So the more you're uploading, the more you're there and present on social media, obviously the more people are going to see you, which leads to larger following and things like that. And I think it's one of those things where it ends up sort of, you know, it can get the better of you in a sense of like it becomes quite addictive, and in a good way of like, this is amazing. Like, you're getting all this sort of attention, this followers going up, it's all great. But there was no real sort of like structural plan put in place of where I wanted to end up, or this is the thing that I really want to go into in the long run. So I think looking back, I would probably set out with more of a plan and maybe a bit less naive to it all, and be like, it is going to turn into a career. You know, although it is fun and it's still a hobby, it will turn into a career, Joe. So you need to have certain things put in place, like certain goals and targets and stuff, and give yourself a bit more of a structure.
But I mean, obviously you were watching this unfold under your roof with your sister as well, who was slightly ahead of you. You could sort of almost travel in her slipstream, I suppose. Were you taking notes furiously and thinking, oh, I'm not doing that, or I should do that more, or, you know?
Yeah, do you know what? It was good, because I sort of got adopted into this group of vloggers who were already sort of on their rise. And so I came a bit late to the party, but I, through my sister, I got to meet a load of other sort of male creators who were in that group. And I was a newbie to the group. And it was, in my own head, I had like my own little competition going on with myself of being like, I wonder if I could get to the level that they're at. So without them even realizing, I was sort of in competition with everyone. I put into my own head of being like, well, if they're uploading twice a week, I've got to upload twice a week. If they're doing this, I've got to do this. And it became like part of my sort of drive and goals was to try and get to that sort of level and even maybe surpass that.
Do you think it was quite important that you had those guys around you in terms of just having a touchstone of somebody else that's going through it? A bit like when you speak to young men who were in boy bands in the 90s, and, you know, it's such a unique and shared experience. And actually, when I look at some of the stuff you were experiencing by way of audience reaction, it was like you were in a boy band. People would mob you and turn up for book signings and scream and cry and ask to touch you.
Yeah, I've seen many a fainter in my time, and, you know, a lot of tears, a lot of fainting, a lot of hysteria. It's something that I never thought I would ever experience in my life. So it's something I don't think any human being sort of is used to or expects of that level when it actually happens. It's very unusual and it's overwhelming, and it makes you feel really good, though. It does make you feel like it makes you feel a bit special in a way and sort of loved, which is good. And I was very lucky that I had not just Casper, who was my roommate at the time, to sort of speak to and talk to and sort of share these experiences with, but also my sister, Alfie, Marcus, Jim, like so many other people in that space. And we were all, the amount of times we used to all hang out together, and we'd all be sort of sat around on our laptops, all editing, but all together and sort of advising each other and sort of sharing what we'd learned, but also sharing the experiences that we've had and how we're feeling and things like that. It was a very sort of close-knit group. And we all went through something together. I think we've sort of come out the other side of that sort of, and always look back on like fond memories, I feel.
Yeah, and I think it's really, maybe you'll come to realize this or appreciate this more as you look back later in life, but I think that probably was a bit of a lifeboat for you all, because you were going through, I mean, an extraordinary experience, but huge in terms of life change, in terms of the money that you were earning, your social standing. I mean, you know, you had girls fainting at the thought of, you know, at the sight of you, and yet you've not had a girlfriend. That's a lot.
Yeah, it was really unusual. It was. And like I said, it's something that we'd never sort of prepared for. It was very sort of, I mean, like, that we had I remember doing like a book signing at the Emirates Stadium for my first book, and just sort of taking moments
just
to be like,
that,
yeah,
that sentence is weird, Joe, right?
Yeah, I know, yeah. And I, you know, I actually almost that sort of in a, I haven't really thought about that for a long time. And now that we're sort of talking about it, I'm like, that just seems mad that at one point in time I was able to, that was even discussed that I'd be able to sort of do that.
Did you have security for events like that?
Yes. Yeah, we did. Yeah. Cause, and it's unusual, I guess, cause some of the security firms that we'd worked with, they're used to, it was like a new sort of breed of fans, I guess, like, because they're from the internet, it was like they knew that you'd pass them in the street and they would know, they feel like they know you because they've watched your life. And I think with online and stuff, that and the sort of YouTube thing, part of that was sort of sharing our experiences in our life. Like vlogging is literally sharing an element of your day with your audience, of what you get up to. So it's all very real. And especially back in the early days, you know, you were more willing to share more of your life and what you're up to and you know, things like that. So your audience really had a strong connection with you and felt like they knew you when you didn't know anything about them. So it made us become way more approachable, I feel like. So at these sort of book signings and meet and greets, you know, we'd get such large turnouts because they felt like we were like a friend of theirs, or but we didn't really know them. So, and in security terms, it was difficult for them because I guess a lot of these security people are used to football fans or like I guess like drunken people at concerts, whereas this was a completely like new breed of audience. I feel like probably going back to like you said about the boy band type thing, and it was very unusual because it was, yeah, it's a wild experience. It's a weird thing back then because you go on stage and you've, it's not like we're singers or you know, like in the West End and, you know, actors and stuff like that. Back then it was we were just going on and sort of doing like Q&A's on stage, but people just go crazy for it. So it was kind of like a lot of chat about trying to figure out like how we do things, like even like that. So like talking about like, okay, so we've got a tour coming up, how do we make it a really fun experience for the audience? Like what can we do that sort of brings a legitness to it? Because I think a lot of that imposter syndrome sort of rang throughout the group, I believe. I mean, I'm speaking for myself, I certainly had it, but I'm sure a lot of the others would have gone through times where they felt it as well, where it was kind of like how has this become this big? Like how do we sort of keep this going at sort of the pace it's going? How do we sort of, you know, make the most of it but also make sure it's a really fun and enjoyable experience for everyone involved?
But also you haven't, you know, you're not a band, so you can't sing.
Yeah.
You're not actors, so you don't act. Like, what do you actually do on stage for those 2 hours that's going to qualify the charge of a ticket, for example?
Yeah,
you
know, exactly.
That is all the stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
And by the way, you're like 20 and you've never done this before and you can thatch roofs.
Yeah. I think there was one discussion where I had where I said, you know, could I just thatch a roof on stage, like a little practice roof? But I don't think that would be entertaining for anyone. But even actually back in those days, they probably would have loved it. It was a weird time where, and this is actually before like podcasts would tour on stage. It was before you get like books, well maybe not before book signings, but you know, you get the books instead of a book signing. It's like you go to a like a stage and you have like an audience and you do like a sort of a basic Q&A about the book on stage. It was, I guess, like that was the only thing we could sort of compare it to in a way, but it was like that, but just very intense screaming, kind of like that, mix that with like a boy band type vibe. It was so unusual.
When I look at that kind of group mentality, one of the sort of previous models, if you like, I could sort of ascribe to it is the Mickey Mouse Club, right? Which where you had like Christina Aguilera, I think it was Ryan Reynolds, Justin Timberlake, Britney Spears.
Ryan Gosling, right? As well. Yeah.
Ryan Gosling, yeah. That's it. Yeah. Ryan Gosling, not Reynolds, yeah. So you get this, you know, this batch of would-be megastars that are going through a shared experience together. Now we know how that worked out for some. Some have fared better than others with their mental health. Was that a concern ever for you guys that you'd look around this room and think, are we all going to be okay with this? Like, you know, managing success is still a job, right? You're really successful, but you've got to stay there. You don't know what you're doing. Nobody knows what you're doing because nobody's ever done this before. Like,
yeah.
That must have been a big concern at some point, maybe, even if it's something your parents raised.
Do you know what? It was, like, for me personally, I, in the moment, I, there was points where I just like naively thought that it would last for forever. I was like, yeah, it's gonna be great. We're gonna always just make content and we're just gonna age it up over time and everyone's gonna grow up and still be addicted to my content when they pass the age of sort of 20 or whatever. But it's not the case, you know. And I kind of wish that I did have more. I mean, I did know that it would eventually happen because that's one of the whole reasons why myself and Casper, who was my roommate at the time and also a YouTuber, that's how we came up with the idea for starting our own management company for social talent. Because we were like, you know, one day we are not going to be, you know, we're not going to be the top dogs of like this sort of portion of the internet. The internet's going to get bigger. Social media is going to get bigger. It's going to be more accessible to everyone, and it's going to, you know, be easier to make content more than ever. It's going to be so many more bigger and sort of, and also like more talented people with bigger, bolder ideas that are going to grasp the sort of short attention span of the internet consumers. And so that's why we were like, let's sort of get ahead of that and in a way kind of be there for the next generation of online talent and use our expertise and sort of the lessons that we've learned over the years to be there if they need to sort of get a longevity out of the online career and hopefully sort of get them to experience really cool things. Like we got to experience some of the most amazing, incredible things as part of our sort of 10-year careers to date. And I just love the fact of then once you've been through something and you've experienced something so great, you then get satisfaction and enjoyment out of seeing someone else go through it, I think.
So maybe that's what you're doing with your hindsight, is you're passing it down with the agency you've created with Casper. I mean, you two are like kind of, you know, Obi-Wan Kenobis in terms of the next generation. You can feel the force and show them the way.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, but that must be quite exciting itself because you've now seen the pace and rhythm of the digital revolution, right? It outstrips the industrial revolution at a rate of knots. So nobody's going to stay that successful for that long unless they are really, really talented, tenacious, and have a head in the books of what's going on in terms of algorithms, which is something I know you do. So I'm going to jump into my next question with you, Joe, and I'm going to give you the mother of all tasks.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
You are amongst the very first generation to not only grow up with the internet, but on it too. And you are uniquely placed in your knowledge of social media and online content. And we all know that the internet is not always a nice place. We're seeing huge numbers of young people walk away from it. Many of your former colleagues and compatriots have stepped back from YouTube. Even megastars like Tom Holland are deleting their socials because they think they need to stay offline to preserve their mental health. Something you've touched on with your book, Grow. So if I was to give you the keys to the kingdom, the online kingdom, Joe,
yep.
Imagine you are, for social media, what Tim Berners-Lee is for the internet. And Tim Berners-Lee, for those that don't know, invented the internet and now is the caretaker of the World Wide Web. I'm going to hand you the keys, Joe. There they are.
Yep.
And you can do whatever you need to do to make it a better space. What are you going to do?
I think sort of with anything that's sort of made, be that sort of social media, anywhere where people can interact with each other, I would, as part of, like, say it's an app or a social media platform, I would have almost like a designated part of that social media platform or that app is to focus on the user experience and making sure that, you know, it's a safe place where they can, if they need, speak to someone and get help and have a bit of assistance. I feel like that's the one thing that we could maybe do better with on the internet. And it's just not. I think it's like a balance between, obviously, businesses want to maximize business. You know, they want to grow things as big as they can. The more users, the better, that kind of thing. And, you know, because one thing that I've been very fortunate with YouTube is that I've had someone, you know, at YouTube that I can talk to. And YouTube, for me, have always been very, very good at talking to their users and the people that's a part of their platform. And I think for me, because of my sort of rise on the platform at an early stage, I've been very fortunate that I've got someone, you know, at YouTube, like a direct contact that I can reach out to if I need help with anything.
It's not just a direct contact, is it, Joe? Let's be honest, right? When the head honcho from YouTube used to come into town from Los Angeles or Silicon Valley, wherever it was that they were based, they would take you for dinner. So, but I mean, like, you know, some people can't even get a complaint registered on Instagram. You got wined and dined by the boss.
Yeah, so, and this is what I would love to sort of make, because that sort of experience for me has made my experience on social media so, I think what a big part of what sort of kept me going on it for so long is the interactions that I've had and the just being able to know that I can reach out to someone. So I think applying that to all users, because even now I keep getting like emails come through that are clearly like these like phishing emails or whatever it is, and I keep reporting them, and I feel like sometimes you report stuff and you just know it's not going to a human being who's going to generally look into it. As much as I know that a lot of things are getting sort of driving towards being sorted out by robots and algorithms and things like that, I still like the idea that human beings, you can, like, I like the idea of being able to reach out and speak to a human. Like, the amount of times you probably call up people and you go through to a robot and you're talking to a robot and you're like, no, I just want to talk to a human, because a human will understand my wants and needs right now. And I think, you know, I think we're going into a time period where people will, if they're not being heard and they're not sort of having the experience that they want, they will start to look elsewhere and will stop using certain platforms. Yeah,
I think that's a very genuine fear, is that people feel that they are part of a community where sometimes, you know, for example, we're called users, right? I think that is just a horrible use of language, because you sound like drug addicts, right? We're not users.
Yeah.
I mean, or we're not customers, because we're not paying to be there, but they are monetizing us. So actually we're clients, if you want to put it that way.
Yeah.
So what's your client services? So I just tried to report, for example, and I know many women of my age that do my sort of job have got, I think it's the same guy, writing pretty disgusting stuff to us on DM, like really out of order stuff. So I've filed so many complaints, but all I get back is a bot. We can't look into this at the moment. We're too busy. Well,
yeah.
If you're going to build communities, you've got to be able to service and manage them, haven't you? So I think that they owe us better as users to at least have somebody there to help us when people are misbehaving within the community. If you applied it to the real world, it would be like living in a society with no government or police, and you wouldn't send somebody to be heard at trial by a bot. A judge with age and wisdom and experience would make that decision or guide a jury. So if you talk about the metaverse and apply it to the real world, we surely have to start populating it with people and not bots.
Yeah, I mean, there's an argument as well that we should, you know, anyone that wants to use the internet should
show themselves.
Show themselves, yeah, and provide information. So like anything you put out there, you know, it's coming from, you can see who it's coming from. And I think that would just, it would just eradicate trolling, I think, by a massive proportion. You know, it would probably, it would make people think, you know, think before they speak. And so that's something as well that I think, you know, should be looked at.
Definitely. I think you should put that on your manifesto, Joe. Maybe I can be one of your clients. But I think making the community accountable so that you're right. You shouldn't be able to hide behind an egg and post abuse. You shouldn't. And then if you do and somebody reports you, there should be a human being that goes, oh my God, as a valued member of our community, I'm so sorry you're going through this. Let me help you. A chatbot that says we're too busy whilst we're looking at the profits that they're posting. And it's like, hang on a minute. Footfall will speak in a moment and we'll all leave.
Exactly. I think it's, I think as well, if you haven't got that there in place, then who do you speak to about it? You can speak to like your parents, your friends about it, but sometimes it's difficult because it's quite, if your family or your friends aren't as online or not in that space or that world that you're in, like for example with me, I was lucky because I had, you know, a group of friends around me that all experienced the same thing. But if you're you know, you love social media and you love being on it, but you're getting sort of awful comments about a certain aspect of whatever, and you know, you're getting these negative comments, but your friends aren't as involved, they could just say, well, you know, don't go on it then. But that's not, you know, that's not the advice you want to hear per se, because it's a place that you shouldn't even be like that in the first place.
Well, no, and also if it's a bit like saying, oh, I went to a nightclub and somebody picked on me and I, you know, it looks like they were really having a go at me. Well, don't go to the nightclub anymore.
We
need to move that person out. Yes. So actually, you know, if we are creating and a metaverse, I mean, you tell me, Joe, what do you understand the metaverse to be? Is it another world that is entirely digital, but a world nonetheless?
Yeah. I guess so. Yeah. I mean, the only thing I can sort of, for me, I've got like a virtual reality headset. I was using it, and it's one of those things where it's like, it showcases some of the best and the worst of everything. I think with anything, you're going to get people that take it to the extremes. I think I was in this thing called VR chat, which is basically like these sort of like virtual reality sort of chat rooms, I guess, but they're designed to be like levels in games, or you can go any place you want as any character you want. And initially I was in there and I had all these people approaching me, and you get some that are just shouting at you and sort of trying to mess with you and things like that. But then there was another community on there that almost came and rescued me from all that. And they showed me this world they were building, and they're all really nice, but they spend that. It was so interesting. I feel like I was like in a documentary, like interviewing these people about, cause they spend so much of their time in this metaverse, like in this sort of digital world, because they actually prefer that than actually being in the real world. And some of them even sleep in VR. So they will actually go to sleep in virtual reality. They wake up and they still have the goggles on. They're still in their virtual apartment or whatever.
Okay, so Joe, as head of social media, recently appointed, is that a good thing?
It's a tricky one to answer, because it's like, if that makes them, I always think it's good to be, I mean, this is, you know, this is why I write about it in my book, but I always think it's so good to get outside, and you don't necessarily have to be on like connected to social media, but just to get outside and appreciate the natural world that we're fortunate enough to be living on. But if their real life is so awful and, you know, they need an escape, is it a bad thing to go somewhere where they are appreciated and they have got friends, be that, you know, they might not actually see them in real life, but they've made these connections with these people that share a similar interest? I like the fact that you can go to the internet to escape from the real, use it as an escape from the real world, and you can go and watch videos on whatever your interests are, and you can go and you can, you know, interact with all whoever you want. And, you know, I like all that. I like that it's kind of like a you know, this space where you can, whatever your interests are, you can go and explore that. The only thing I think is that it is a bit of a, and always has been since the beginning, a bit of a Wild West. Do you know what I mean? I think there's always more that can be done to make it a safe space for everyone. there's always more that could be done. And that's something that I would love to see in the future.
I mean, ultimately, the internet is a brilliant thing. And if used for good, it's one of our greatest resources, man-made resources. You know, when Tim Berners-Lee was working up that algorithm, he knew straight away, in order for this to be good and to do good, nobody can own it. So he's never made money from inventing the internet in the way that anybody else, like a Mark Zuckerberg has, for example, or a Jack Dorsey or whoever, because he understood that its intent, it was built with the intention of doing good. And I do believe that there is so much good to be gained from it still.
Yeah, I think it's interesting as well that, because I feel like Tim Berners-Lee, he's not, if you asked, I might be wrong on this, but I think if you asked the younger generation the name of the person who invented the internet, they wouldn't know that it was Tim Berners-Lee, but they know Mark Zuckerberg, they know Jack Dorsey, they know all the people that are on that created these big apps, which I think is a new, like, interesting.
Yeah. Well, with the thought of groundbreaking firsts at the forefront of my mind, I'm going to jump into our third and final question, if that's okay.
Right. Yep.
Somebody who has been right at the fore of some really big, significant changes. I mean, you sat at the heart of an online implosion. I'd like to talk through some of your other significant firsts, Joe, if that's okay.
Of course.
And I wanted to start with the first time you felt like an adult.
First time I felt like an adult. I do you know what? I feel like it's quite recently, which may surprise you. I think, like, post-London move down to the countryside with my girlfriend, sort of feeling very settled. I think as well, like, the sort of post, I say post, you know, like YouTube, but it's not. I still do use social media an awful lot, but it's, and I still consider that as, you know, one of my main jobs. But I think, like, that kind of, that sort of chapter of the sort of hysteria of that sort of time on YouTube where, you know, we were the group that sort of went on to do all these amazing things. I feel like that sort of chapter is now sort of, now that I've turned 30, that sort of chapter's come to a close now, and it's now time for, like, a new sort of chapter. One where I can sort of, it's like going back to your comment about the sort of Disney stars in the past. Like, I don't want to, if I was to compare it to the Disney stars, I don't want to stay boxed into that you are still the Disney star. I want to move on and be an adult, being able to sort of do what I want to do, and just find new avenues and find new things to work on. So so that's what I would do.
You have a voracious appetite, and I hear just by the way that you talk that you really try to dig deep into the business of your business. You don't just leave that for other people to do. I'm sure, you know, that you would study the data that comes back from your content, and you know how to read it and improve upon it and all of that stuff.
Do you know what? I never used to do that. To me, that was a distraction, because I've always considered myself as, like, purely creative. So I love to make stuff and do things. And, like, I paint, I draw, I sculpt, I do all these different, like creative outlets. And for me, the idea of, like, data crunching, I used to think that would slow me down. And I thought, used to think, like, even, like, looking at sort of, yeah, all that kind of behind the scenes stuff, to me, I used to just sort of, I think now I just don't want to concentrate on that. But now, as I'm getting older, and especially, like, things like with the production company and sort of doing these more kind of, like, businessy ventures, it's something that is actually a very vital tool in sort of making new stuff, I think. So it's something now that over time, and in this new chapter of my life is now sort of much more important to me.
I should have flagged this earlier, actually. Congratulations. You've just signed a deal with the BBC to create...
Yeah, BBC Studios.
Your production company, which is part of the BBC Studios setup.
Yes, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's with... BBC Studios, sort of, they had a lot of faith in us back in the day. This is going back, I think, 2014-15. We did a feature with BBC Studios called Joe and Casper Hit the Road, and it was very different. It's straight to DVD sort of release. But they sort of took a punt on us, and it paid off, and it was so nice working with them, and I've sort of stayed in contact with that sort of team ever since. And And obviously things like Strictly have sort of helped sort of build that relationship. And I've always been really interested in how TV shows are made, like formats. I love the idea of working on formats, coming up with new format ideas. So we had the conversation and we managed to sort of come to an agreement, and I'm super excited to sort of essentially be working with my sort of, I guess, career parents in a weird way. That's what it feels like anyway.
It's really interesting though, Joe, isn't it? Because actually the BBC need to learn from people like you, and you need to learn from the people at the BBC, right? So it's fantastic that you guys have come together, because now what we're seeing is, for example, Mr. Beast. I'm sure you know about Mr. Beast, right? For anybody that doesn't, Mr. Beast is a YouTuber fundamentally, right? Yes. Who's out there and he gives away tons of money, and fundamentally that's kind of his shtick, isn't it? Gaming the opportunity for his followers to win huge amounts of money. Mm-hmm. So he, one of his most recent ones, I mean, his audience is huge. It's like 150 million subscribers. You can't even get it. I mean, it's not even BBC numbers, that's Netflix numbers.
Yeah.
And he did a half hour, I think it was a 30 minute pastiche homage to Squid Games.
Yes.
Got more views than Squid Games.
Yeah.
It cost millions to make. It made millions in views. I mean, this is, the numbers are telephone numbers in terms of the noughts that sit at the end of
This is the thing though, with social media and the internet and stuff, it's just the speed that it happens. Like, he was able to sort of, to be honest, like that, when he brought out his Squid Games, his version of Squid Games, it was, I bet you he would have actually wanted to bring out even earlier, but because it was such a big production, it does take a bit of time to make. But even then, it's so much quicker than perhaps a TV show gets turned around in. And this is the whole point of what I'm trying to build with my production company, is sort of being that sort of hybrid that sits there, is going to bridge between the two worlds and become something that people will come to and hopefully work with me on to make stuff that's going to be, for me, it's all about having those quick turn times. So if you've got the idea, let's jump on it, let's make it happen. But also and I think what the internet does well is that they take risks. They don't, you know, they come up with an idea, they film that idea straight away, they edit it, turn it around, put it out there, market it, all in the space of like 2 weeks. And I'm not saying that we must do that, but taking that mentality and applying it to TV and taking risks on new formats and stuff is something that I'm really passionate about.
Totally. And I think, you know, that's where telly's got to learn, is you've got to become more agile. If that was put in front of one of the main broadcasters, they'd have about 8 weeks of meetings, and then they'd have to reschedule the meetings because somebody's got to go to the dentist And actually, the internet is just running rings around them at the same time. Creating content is as good in some cases.
And all these TV channels, they all have now an online version of their station, which I think there's going to be a lot of people making content specifically for those online, VOD-type platforms, because I think that will give people
VOD
access.
Is video on demand, just...
Yes, yeah, like sorry, that? Yeah, yeah. I think it will encourage a lot of people to try out and test out new formats and stuff that they would never normally take a risk on.
What about when you were first really on the rise, Joe, and branding agencies, advertising agencies would get in touch because they wanted to collaborate with you? Yeah. Did you feel like an adult in those moments or a total intruder?
There was a lot of times where I did sort of think, I mean, I thought it was really cool. Like some of the brands, I mean, I'm one of these people that sort of, you know, I do pick and choose who I work with. I'm fortunate that I can do that, that I have got the choice to sort of be like, that's a lovely amount of money and thank you very much, but I wouldn't promote that, or I wouldn't do that. It just doesn't fit right for me, and I don't think my audience would sort of resonate with it and things like that. So I'm fortunate that I can sort of do that. I've worked with some really, really cool brands and brands that I love, and I had some really, really amazing experiences sort of with them, which has been really cool.
But it must have been a case of like, they call you into these swanky sort of offices in London and you're ushered in and they make a fuss of you because they want you to work with them and for them. And they're flattering you and tickling your tummy as best they can. That must feel quite huge and overwhelming at times if you are just a young guy that was doing roofs a couple of years ago.
Yeah, no, it does. I mean, the first like big brand work I can remember doing was with Skype. And part of the campaign was, I think they were sort of branching out and doing something different in that space. And as part of the deal, they flew me out first class. I bear in mind, this is when I was still on a roof. I'd never flown on my own in my life or been further than... I had been traveling before that. So I had been to LA before, but I'd never flown... I'd never turned left on the plane ever until this moment. And I was on my own. It was the first time I flew on my own. And it just blew my mind. I flew out there to work with Skype. And part of the deal was going to Simon Cowell's house to interview him as part of this sort of... this thing they were bringing out, and that whole scenario was terrifying. Like I felt very much like, why me? Why have I been picked to do this? Like, this is so random. Is it just because they like the numbers that I'm pulling in and things like that? It must be, I guess, because I'm really awkward and I can't interview people very well. Still to this day, I'm not very good at interviewing people. I just felt like, yeah, that was my first experience of imposter syndrome and kind of like that sort of, am I supposed to be doing this?
That's in at the deep end there, because Simon's not easy.
Yeah, it was terrifying, because obviously, you know, he is Mr. Scary, and it's like, there I am, sort of.
He won't sit there and try to make it easy for you. I mean, he certainly wouldn't make it difficult for you, but he's not going to think, oh, this kid's really nervous, let me just like put him at his ease. He'll just be like literally looking at his clock, because his diary just runs all day. And...
Yeah. And it's one of those things, like, now if I was asked to do it, I would probably pass. My sort of priorities have changed, I think. I think back in the early days, it was kind of like bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, like everything was just like, oh my God, this is incredible. Yeah, I've got to do this. Because back then I thought, you know, this might only last a year, this career. So if I can say, if my chat down the pub can be, oh, I met Simon Cowell once and I've turned left on a plane, that'd be like my stories that I stick with for the rest of my life, and just so I could experience those things. Whereas now I feel like I'm a bit more sort of settled and more comfortable in myself of what I want to do and what I, you know, I don't want to do, I think.
What about the first time you fell in love? Because that came much later in life, didn't it?
Yeah, I think the first time I definitely had my... love interests growing up, like through my teenage years, the MSN day. I don't know if you remember MSN.
Yeah.
So like MSN, there was a girl that I used to be madly in love with. What I thought it was, I used to throw the love word around way too much back in those days. But I feel like I didn't really know. That wasn't, to me, wasn't obviously true love. But yeah, definitely with Diane, that's definitely the first time I've ever experienced love. Other than like love, like family love, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but it's different, isn't it? And to the point where you want to be with that person all the time and you want to live under the same roof as them. Was there a part of you that was thinking you were a bit punch drunk on the old Strictly glitter ball impact? Because there was not only you and Diane that fell in love on that series, but you went all the way to the finals with Stacey Dooley and Kevin, who also had a similar experience and got together after the show.
Yeah. Do you know what? I think it was one of those things where on that show, I think you see the best in someone and the worst in someone. Because especially if you get to those later stages, you know, you're spending like 12-hour days. It's like, it is very intense, and you fall out. Like, we fell out plenty of times, I'm sure. Like, every week we're like, oh, we're going home. Because I always felt like I needed to make her proud. And I'm not a natural dancer. I can't dance. So I had to purely rely on Diane to teach me. And so, like, when you get to those later rounds, it gets very stressful. It gets very, like, it gets very intense. So, like, you do sort of see, I'm sure she saw the worst in me and I saw the worst in her some of those weeks when we thought we were going home. And it wasn't until, like, after the shows, like, you think, like, you know, if that's what someone's worst is, like, in the grand scheme of things, that's nothing. And, you know, the positives massively outweighed the bad. So it's like, I always thought I won't ever know. Like, when it's that whole cliche of like, when you know, kind of thing. And it wasn't straight away. It wasn't apparent. But then afterwards, it was kind of like, it was almost like, I think we were so focused on getting to that final. And I was so focused on, because, you know, you always end up wanting to do it for your partner. I think a lot of the celebrities will agree with me, where it's like, it becomes, yeah, it'd be nice to win, but it's more, you're doing it more for the person who dances their life. Do you know what I mean? And it's very competitive in the dance world. And so you're doing it for them. And so it wasn't until sort of afterwards that we had time to sort of put all those thoughts together and sort of express our feelings, I guess. properly.
It's an interesting dynamic, isn't it? Because actually, you're the big name star. You're the celebrity booking. But from the moment you get partnered up, she's the boss. Because actually, you are bowing to her greater knowledge. Mm-hmm. And then for you to go on and form a relationship at the end of that, I wonder how that dynamic informs what you've become as boyfriend and girlfriend.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're both actually very career-focused, which works really well for me and really well, luckily, really well for her. It's like, because obviously with dancing, she's away a lot of the time. She's, you know, she's on tours a lot. She's rehearsing for Strictly a lot. So we don't, so it's very much like we're away from each other a lot. We stay in contact an awful lot, like privately. And then when she comes home or when I come home and we're together, it kind of makes that time more special and we value it more and we do things for ourselves. Of course, we share certain elements of it online, but a majority of it we actually just do for ourselves. I think that's really healthy as well. I think there's an expectation because we are relationship formed on camera. Like you can literally watch the moment we met. It's really bizarre. I mean, I did a show that Who Do You Think You Are show, and I was finding out about my family heritage, and I was like, what's really weird is that like my 11 times great grandkids in the future, they're going to be able to watch back their 11 times great grandfather. Most of his career, and they've been able to pinpoint the moment where he met, you know, their 11 times great grandmother. And it's so unusual for them to watch back on whatever the platform will be back then. I don't know. They'll have to search the archives. We really do value, like, I think it's really healthy for us to, although it's expected maybe us to share quite a lot online with our viewers and with the people that watched us, our relationship, I think it's a lot more, like I said, healthier for us to enjoy those private moments together and have that element of like being able to share what we want to share, but actually keep most of it back for ourselves.
Well, and you've also shifted in some respects because she is now one of your clients. You represent her.
We do. Yeah, exactly. I think especially, I mean, her following grew massively when we got partnered on Strictly. And it was that kind of thing. We did find like, you know, there was a lot more sort of interest in her like online wise, obviously once the followers start to grow. And it was that thing of like, I was giving her a lot of advice throughout that time and sort of things that knowledge that I'd learned and things and helping her with a lot of that kind of aspect. So it did become that bigger discussion of, well, I've got a management company who, you know, whose job it is to look after clients like yourself. So and that's a big wider team. So it's so what's great is it's that all that kind of stuff is delegated to other members of staff who are all amazing at their jobs and really look after the clients. So it's it seemed like a bit of a no-brainer.
My final first for you, your first significant life lesson.
First significant life lesson. I would say it's to not listen to the negative voice in your head. I think there's been times in the past, it's hard to pick out specifics, but like in the past, there's definitely things that I've sort of thought were beyond me and too scary and too much of a risk and too putting myself out there a bit too much, where I look back on now and think you should have just done it. And I think what really sort of amplifies that now in my head is the fact that I did do Strictly and especially even the West End musical Waitress, because that for me, I was riding high off confidence for the back of Strictly. And so I was like, yeah, of course I'll go on for audition for a West End musical. And then I realized that actually a part of it is obviously singing songs. I'd never sung on stage. And there was an expectation with Strictly is that I came in as a non-dancer. So they weren't expecting me to be good. Whereas in a West End musical, they're expecting you to be good because you've got an audience that are coming in that aren't coming to watch it because you're in it, Joe Sugg. They're coming to watch the show as a whole and be entertained. They're coming from all different parts of the world to enjoy West End theatre. So it was very sort of, when I look back at it now, it's one of those things that's like, it's one of those things of like thinking, I can't believe you actually did that. I'm so glad that I did something. I mean, I hate using this word, but like something out of my comfort zone, that whole thing of like doing something out of your comfort zone. I'm like every single person that goes on Strictly goes, this is out of my comfort zone. But though Strictly and the West End thing really was something that sort of was quite sort of exposing. And you know, it was very like, he's from this era of entertainment. Can he be doing this or doing this and trying this? I look back now, I'm like, yes, of course. Why not? You've got these opportunities. Take them. Like, you're not going to live forever. Just make the most of it and just enjoy it whilst you can.
Well, Joe, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I really am intrigued to see what the next 10 years look like for you.
Oh, thanks, Kate.
A huge thanks to Joe, whose new book, Grow, is available wherever you get your books from the 15th of September. And if you're in the mood for more great chat, look no further than our back catalogue, where you'll find episodes with Scarlett Moffat, Giovanna Fletcher, Vernon Kay, Kate Lawler, Georgia Toffolo, Pete Wicks, Zara McDermott, Jamie Lang, Emily Attack, Roman Kemp, Craig Revel-Hallward, Shelley Ballas, Emma Barton, Kelvin Fletcher, and Liz Marland, and many more. As always, the show is produced by me, Kate Thornton, with Ben Robbins and the Yahoo Studios team. Our editing is by Andy Axon, and our music comes courtesy of Andy Bell. All that remains for me to say is thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Marc Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Marc.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.